Well, good day and welcome back to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and it's great to have you all joining us here. We're actually coming back with part two of our episode we began last week with Dr. Seth Hawkins, who came in to talk to us about wilderness medicine and wilderness EMS and how that ties in and relates to disaster response. He's an experienced disaster response doctor, member of a DMAT team in North Carolina, and also an experienced educator and trainer for disaster EMS. So we're going to continue with part two as we continue this discussion. Joining us on the call as well, my co-host Sam Bradley, paramedic in California, as well as our two friends from Paragon Medical Education Group, Dr. Joe Holly and Jim Logan, both from Tennessee Task Force 1 USAR team and principal educators over at Paragon Medical Education Group. Without further ado, let's jump into this segment here at the Disaster Podcast, part two of last week's segment talking about wilderness EMS and disaster response.
Hey, Seth.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, so where were you in Katrina? Were you there?
I was sitting in North Carolina wishing I was there.
Okay. I didn't know because that was like the most wilderness experience for me ever. That was so it was very surreal. No available resources whatsoever. So a lot of people think that, you know, FEMA got a horrible rap on that response. And I can say that some of it was justified, but from the Urban Search and Rescue and DMAT community, we were on target. We were on point, and we were there as the hurricane came in. We were in Shreveport, came in right behind it. We were on site before the levees broke. So not a lot of people know that kind of thing, and so was DMAT. DMAT was there as well at the Louis Armstrong airport. So those two elements of FEMA were prepared, they were ready, but it was certainly ties into your wilderness perspective.
Yeah, no, I completely agree, and that's kind of my point, is that, again, we have moved to a point where we've accepted the idea that the government can be tasked with adequately managing something that by definition has exceeded the ability to be managed, which is tautological. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's just fascinating from an intellectual standpoint. But operationally speaking, we all know that was one city. So should we see, you know, the Eastern Seaboard, or should we see the San Andreas Fault? Should we see something happen which involves multiple communities and which exceeds our ability federally to respond? I think we find ourselves inevitably in a circumstance where we are locally delivering disaster care, and the degree to which we can train our local providers to step up and to activate the skill sets that kind of everybody knows that they can do, but they're not regulated to do yet. I think that's kind of an exciting idea. And I think that that it moves us, it's one increment in providing us additional tools in the toolbox beyond the idea that help is coming. That's something in wilderness medicine that's a little bit of a flaw, is that if you take a wilderness medicine class, it teaches you how to temporize the injuries or illness in that patient until help arrives. It's the old Red Cross, you know, like until a high level of care arrives. And the danger with that in a wilderness medicine standpoint, again, in the emperor's new clothes or no clothes kind of story, is that there's not a lot of very, very high speed, low drag wilderness EMS teams in this country that are just waiting to swoop in and accept your patient. And it speaks what we were talking about earlier with the mudslide, that you're there like, dude, this is like, you know, they're drowning in Jell-O, and we're looking for the Jell-O drowning response team. And has nobody ever thought to build a Jell-O drowning response team? And then the blame, you know, is on the response agencies and on the government. When, you know, in fact, maybe you should be thinking that you work in a Jell-O factory. And, you know, that's kind of my message. So from a wilderness toolkit standpoint, honestly, there's, you know, well, first of all, there's all sorts of cool high-tech stuff that, you know, people get jazzed up about carrying into the wilderness. And then there are some neat things that have multiple uses that aren't expected, like the Foley catheter story. But I am absolutely convinced that the people that we send out are far and away our most versatile, most like dramatic game changers for what comes, you know, is brought to bear. And they can be leveraged, I think, far more in local incidents than you know, we may be doing so far. I know there's a lot of community action teams, and there's a lot of local organizing. And I'm not meaning to say that that doesn't exist, but certainly some of the things we do in wilderness medicine, as far as creating operationally specific scopes of practice where people, I mean, right now, I think 11 states in the country, the last time I did research on this, allow for the reduction of dislocated extremities at the EMS level, up even including paramedic trained responders. So that's just not going to be all that helpful if you're in a disaster and you're waiting for the doctor to show up to reduce somebody's dislocated shoulder, when you know you've been trained to do it in a wilderness medicine course and you can do it in a couple minutes, and it completely changes the entire circumstances of that person's medical care during the disaster.
Well, on that note, and relating back to something, you know, when Jim was talking about his wilderness experience at Katrina, sometimes in the middle of a big metropolitan disaster, we have those little pockets of wilderness medicine. My team was at the Superdome, and I don't need to tell you how outnumbered they were. There was no light. There was no, except ambient sunlight. There was no, very little electricity. There was no air conditioning. There was a whole lot of other problems. And the biggest issue was there were way too many of them and way too few of us. What it meant is that we need to take the resources we have, as you were saying, Seth. We need to find our first responders or our EMTs and kick them up to a whole new level in order to get things done. So EMTs were actually learning and doing skills that weren't generally in their scope of practice. And the interesting thing was, it kind of, as a training officer for a DMED, it kind of came down through the federal chain. Maybe we should be training these people on some of these skills. If it really hits the fan like that, and you don't have enough people to do what needs to be done, you know, maybe we need to train more people to do it, even though it's not something they do every day. So it's kind of in line with what you're saying there, Seth.
Yeah, and I think the interesting innovation that the Pagets are bringing to this is the idea of actually creating a state regulatory framework by which it would be legal and appropriate and under the auspices of formal medical oversight. That's, I think, the really interesting thing that they bring to the table, since I think it happens anyway, but in this way, it's actually with foresight.
What do you think, Joe? How would that work in Tennessee?
Oh, I think that's a great idea. You know, I mean, it's sort of freeing up those resources to do what we know they can do. And, you know, there's a couple of different approaches to that. Part of it has to do with, you know, keeping just simply having regulation in place that allows in a quote unquote declared disaster to sort of put all those rules and regulations on hold. A lot of states have done that, but of course you have to get to the phase where the governor has officially declared a disaster before you can do that. So, you know, I think there's kind of working at that from both sides. Part of that is pushing more training toward those first response people, and the ability to also have the state be able to relax those rules when the situation calls for it. But neither one of those things are going to bridge the entire gap, so you sort of have to do both.
I'm curious about that, Joe. What states have that, and how does that work? So you're saying, if a disaster is declared, then there's a loosening up of protocols for that event?
Not necessarily protocol, but almost every state has the ability to sort of relax the or put in place a sort of different set of rules. You know, and those can be anything from altered standards of care you know, that affects physicians and hospitals and nurses and all sorts of folks, but also the ability to, you know, not Well, I guess one example I can think of for EMS specifically is the ability of EMS providers to administer vaccines or prophylactic medications in the event of a massive outbreak of some infectious agent of some sort. And if the governor declares a disaster for SARS or Ebola or whatever, then that frees up EMS providers to administer prophylactic medications that they wouldn't be doing as part of their normal practice, but they would be allowed to assist the health department or whatever entity in the event of a quote-unquote disaster.
Well, on that note, I got to throw this out there, and maybe Seth has some thoughts on it, but our state's very involved in a pilot on community paramedicine, and one of the things we've been discussing, in fact, I'm helping to write the book on that, but one of the things that makes that neat is this extra level of training they are getting also puts in them in a position to almost kind of be a health mentor or someone that can assist their agency in ways that most paramedics can't. So that gives them a skill set, like you were saying, Joe, where if there's some mass need for mass immunizations or something, they're capable of doing that. And of course, as time goes by, we're going to have more and more of those. You think that kind of thing will be helpful in a disaster?
If I can jump in before Seth does, Sean talked about that very thing with the Washington State, the Snohomish County community paramedics were actually brought into the mudslide, and their job was to tend to the responders.
That's right. I forgot about that.
And so they realized they had this resource that could be used to manage injury and illness for the responders, so that they could stay at peak efficiency and health to the best that they could by utilizing the community paramedic resource as an almost on-scene primary care resource for the responders that were on location. So I'm just throwing that out there. That's something that Sean talked about when we covered the mudslide. But Seth, what are your thoughts?
Oh, I so agree with this. And I really am a big fan of the terminology of mobile integrated healthcare as an overarching theme to community paramedicine. And I think it speaks so well to that may be much of the linkage of what we're talking about, where the more that this can be integrated into the pre-existing environment and the care needs it has, the better it's going to be. So clearly what we're talking about when we're talking about leveraging wilderness training for use during disaster settings is exactly that integrated component, where instead of having silo training, we're actually using multiple different environmental and operationally specific skill sets towards the common goal of taking care of a patient in an unexpected kind of setting. And so I think the integrated part to that is what really I think that's what you're describing, and that's one of the things that excites me most about community paramedic programs. And then the mobile part is what EMS brings to the table that nobody else does. And that's where I think that activities like this, where the personnel are already embedded in communities or they're already geared towards responding, you've solved a huge part of the problem for what would otherwise be like what you take a bunch of hospital providers and you put them in SUVs and you try to drive them out somewhere and it's a disaster. You know, these are people that are already trained and prepared to respond in the field and to deliver care in the field. So rather than moving, people to the hospital to get vaccines, why not use your mobile healthcare providers who are already geared for that and make them integrated into the public health system? And I think that speaks to this is one of the things where I sometimes get slightly more controversial potentially, but that speaks to me about an extremely different perspective about disaster medicine versus wilderness medicine, is that I think it's not a surprise that after a couple minutes of talking about disaster medicine, we inevitably veer into public health and population-based sort of initiatives, because that's really the hallmark of what disaster medicine is dealing with a population-based environmental or human-generated medical challenge. And that's really a key difference between these two, in a way that I think both in terms of our training and our operational activities, we don't expect them to work the same. And one of the jokes I make that sometimes I'm on a DMAT team and I'm a huge DMAT fan, and I actually agree with the operational objectives of a DMAT deployment, but it interests me that our activities in that regard are geared towards replicating or as much as possible, reconstructing a healthcare infrastructure that already existed. So we're looking to bring in technology and to deliver as close as possible hospital-based care to people that have lost that service. So we're bringing in mobile hospitals, and we're bringing in ultrasound machines and CT scanners and X-ray machines, which is cool and exciting. And of course, you know, North Carolina is home to Med One, you know, the Carolinas Medical Center mobile hospital that gets driven around. And I agree with that as being one important element of responding to a disaster, because people still have needs for operations and for imaging and for physician level care. But if you think about it, that's very different from the way we approach wilderness medicine. We really, you know, if you showed up at a wilderness medicine conference and showed how you could transport an X-ray machine in a backpack, it would have a gee whiz factor. It would also have a real like skepticism factor. Like, is really our goal, you know, going to be to get X-ray capability into a wilderness setting? So I think partly what we're getting at is that during a disaster, we're looking for things like delivering vaccines and providing public health services and really reconstructing the medical infrastructure that was there. And I think the best disaster responses, the ones that I at least feel like are the most reputable or have the most noble goals, are the ones that try to leave the systems better than when they came. You know, we're all afraid of the sort of huge first month or 2 month response to an international disaster that then evaporates a year later, and the system is worse maybe than it was before. Not by any action of the responding teams, except that there was no long-term plan for how that public health infrastructure could be rebuilt. That's really not a part of wilderness medicine. Wilderness medicine is very insertional in the sense that it comes in, it's delivering care, it's leaving. You get your helicopter in, you get the person out, and partly that's because the philosophical concept is you're actually supposed to keep the environment that's so threatening in its own state. So we, to some extent, try to maybe prevent, you know, avalanches and do, make areas as safe as possible. But the true wilderness areas, we really try to keep in a pristine state, meaning we try to keep them dangerous. So that's a really big difference, I think, between the two responses and the two environments that we're in, is that, for instance, in Nepal, with that disaster response, this is biased because I'm affiliated with them, but one of my favorite recipients of funds to deal with that is the nascent Nepal EMS system, where they've just in the last couple of years built the first EMS system in the country. And the reason I like supporting that as a disaster response team is that they will remain in the country as long as they can. Like they are the team for the country to deal with not just disasters but everyday medical care. And that, looking at building up an infrastructure, is very different, I think, from our wilderness medicine response model. So that's why I think it's really natural and exciting that we're, you know, thinking right away about how do we bring more and more and more resources into a disaster setting to really quickly transform it into something that is going to be able to address people's healthcare needs as much as possible. And there's a real minimalist philosophy in wilderness medicine where you're really not as interested in delivering comprehensive care as much as you're really interested in simply purely stabilizing and moving the patient to somewhere else where it's much more stable. And that partly speaks to the fact that it's just easier in a wilderness setting. You're usually going down the mountain or you're getting out of the flood zone. In a disaster, you know, of course, the huge second stage to the whole care plan is how do you move massive numbers of people out of an area that's not, you know, that's no longer safe.
And Joe, I'm seeing a huge parallel based on what he's describing right now between that level of wilderness medicine and USAR, much more so than DMAT, don't you think?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of overlap there for sure. And, it sort of goes back to what we talked about before. I think the wilderness aspect of that is exactly as Seth described. It's really about, on the wilderness side, getting the patient out of the environment, and on the USAR side, it's an environment that used to be not wilderness that now has many of the characteristics of wilderness, and so that in many cases involves moving patients out of that environment and attempting to restore it back to normal. And I think Seth's point of wilderness medicine's you know, one of the goals there is to leave it as it's supposed to be, which is dangerous and wild and wilderness. That's certainly a key difference, but the similarities are tremendous as well.
Jim, we haven't heard from you for a few minutes. What are your thoughts? Did we lose the Sasquatch again?
We might have. I still show him on the call, but I'll chime in.
Okay, Jamie.
And my thoughts are that I was jotting a few things down as Seth was talking. Really, you know, we talk a lot about preparedness on this show, and it really comes down to building community resilience. I remember in a public health conference I attended recently, and Sam, you were there at the preparedness summit with the NACHO folks that we were working with for a couple of years. They talked a lot in public health sectors about how healthier communities were by very nature, they were able to better withstand disaster events. If a community is healthier, they don't need as much chronic disease care and things like that. So therefore, they are able to manage themselves a little bit more more effectively. And so my curious question is for Seth is, what are your thoughts about preparedness from a wilderness side? Is there a way to prepare yourself other than just make sure you've got the basic kit of supplies and dual-purpose tools and things that you can put into your pack, and then use your best guess and best improvisational skills to deal with incidents as they arise?
Yeah, I'm kind of cranky on this subject, and so I hope you'll bear with me because it's not probably the direct answer that you're looking for. But I am so committed to the idea that our team-based wilderness EMS response has to be much, much stronger than it is right now. We've got a number of areas in this country that have amazing wilderness EMS response teams that that do amazing work. They're not necessarily totally mobile, so it's not as likely that the Rocky Mountain Rescue Group, you know, is necessarily going to be flown to Tennessee. Not to say Tennessee doesn't have great service as well, but they're not quite as mobile as our disaster teams tend to be just institutionally and by heritage. And really what that speaks to is local areas really have to build up their responses. And I think honestly, my response to that is the same as the one I make to people who ask me in the middle, and I'm sure you guys all have this as well, in the middle of a disaster, they say, how can I get to Nepal? How can I get to Haiti? I got to go there and help. And every single report I've seen from Nepal right now says, please don't come if you are a well-meaning healthcare provider. We do not need well-meaning healthcare providers. And we all know, you know, on the one hand, there's a risk to yourself. On the other hand, there's also the very likelihood that you won't be very helpful just as an individual. But our message, or at least my message, is usually take that energy you have right now for this current event, and there will be another one in a year, and use that energy to join a team. Join a team now when you have that energy. It's going to be a little bit hard at first. There'll be bureaucracy, there'll be paperwork. But the interesting thing that I think speaks to your question is that in wilderness medicine, we very much accept the idea of self-deployment because it kind of has to be, right? You're hiking and you come around a corner and there's somebody lying unconscious and you don't know if they've been hit by lightning or do they have a heart attack or what happened. And you're suddenly tasked with taking care of them. That's a good Samaritan, first responder, unexpected, you know, ad hoc situation. And we all, you know, I think it's great to prepare people for that. But to the extent that you ever want to take that slightly more and actually start carrying stuff and preparing to deal, you know, with a medical situation, guess what? You've got that EMS blood in you. You've got the bug. And use that minute, you should be looking locally at the resources you have to get more training and to join a team, if only, you know, in an episodic volunteer kind of standpoint, or just to see what it is. So that's, I think, my message about the most important thing, you know, to do when you have that feeling like you want to have slightly more training. That's what got me into medicine in the first place, was knowing that I would be going far out into wilderness areas and I wanted to know what to do to help people. And the more I learned about it, the more exciting it was. And gradually my thinking changed from wilderness medicine to wilderness EMS. And I think that migration of thought is the same one in disaster medicine, that goes from sort of casually thinking in the back of your head what you do if the river flooded outside your house and having a kit in your house to take care of yourself to that next step where you're like, boy, when that does happen, my family's safe. They're going to have all that stuff. I'd love to know what I can do for my neighbors. And that's EMS. That's stepping into the pre-planned delivery of healthcare, and it needs to be regulated. You need to be trained for it. It needs to have medical oversight. And that's I think a little bit of what we're missing in the wilderness EMS world is it's very heavily flavored with wilderness medicine and very diluted with wilderness EMS. And I think that could be much that could follow the disaster model of being much more fleshed out.
That's beautifully stated, Seth. We all agree on that. We're just talking on the side here. And Jamie, we always end up talking about training and how important it is, and I think that's been Seth's message all the way through this. And, you know, I'm thinking of anybody that goes out there and even takes a day hike should at least have some basic understanding. That's why they get in trouble out there. They don't have a basic understanding of what they're doing. So then you take that to the next level, which is not only knowing how to take care of yourself, but knowing how to take care of others. Boy, I couldn't agree more on that. What do you think, Jamie?
Well, I was just thinking the same thing. And actually, I pulled up, Seth, I pulled up landmarklearning.edu, looking at the wilderness courses you guys offer. And, you know, it just speaks to the fact that people can really avail themselves of these resources, especially if they're already receiving some medical training and they want wilderness expertise specifically. There are resources like what you all offer at Landmark Learning. And so you have all of these different courses and a variety of things. I'm looking at outdoor skills and outdoor instructor courses, backcountry ethics, which sounds interesting to me just by itself, just by its title alone, or risk management with dealing with wilderness situations. So all kinds of things that go beyond just first aid.
And that's a whole different set than what Joe and Jim do at Paragon. I can see it. There is so much good stuff out there. Joe, do you touch on anything like that, or is this something totally different?
I don't think it's totally different. You know, I think there are definitely some shared skill sets there. But as Seth excellently pointed out, there's also some differences between the two. Part of that's perspective. Part of that's the goals of the system, et cetera. But you know, I think process-wise, there's an awful lot of similarity between the two. And in its simplest form, it's an austere environment with limited capability, and the need to get the patient to someplace that has, you know, more robust resources. And that perspective goes from the individual in the wilderness setting to the population in a disaster setting.
So, Seth, any final thoughts as we kind of get ready to wrap up here? What your thoughts are about where people can reach out in their areas? Because wilderness is, it can happen anywhere, really. I mean, there are wilderness areas in some of the most urban, highly populated areas of the country.
Oh yeah, you're so right. And that's the Gusteau principle that we often sort of begin and end our wilderness EMS medical director course with. And so, I don't mean to oversell the idea that you have to join a team to be properly trained in, you know, in either disaster or wilderness care. I think that's an important leap that I see many people make where they want to move from individual care to group level care. And I think really the most important message, honestly, is the importance of enhancing and making more widespread the availability of quality training that takes the interest that people have and translates it into defensible, evidence-based modern medical care. And then I think the other really important thing is just building response apparatus that address the fact that there's a little bit of sort of a perverse NIMBY kind of thing, you know, a not in my backyard kind of thing, which is not that people don't want something there. They just don't think it could ever happen there. And so I think it's really startling to me the expectations people have on emergency managers and disaster planners and wilderness EMS responders, that they really expect a level of sophistication that's potentially, you know, beyond what we can actually deliver at this time, which is really just setting the bar for us to improve. And that, you know, I think that because of the existence of things like FEMA and DMATs and USAR teams, and by the way, I totally agree with the idea that USAR may be the prototypical merging of these two fields, because it's a search and rescue team, which boy, just the name of that just speaks wilderness medicine, inserted into an urban environment. So that was a really brilliant call to say that kind of merges them. And I think that, you know, to the extent that we have all these services and they get a fair amount of press, people expect that, you know, there's somebody working on this full time who's going to be awesome when, you know, when the thing happens. And we all know that varies as far as how much penetration it has into a local area. So yeah, the more we can stretch to meet the expectations of our consumers and really our society for what we can provide as far as healthcare in austere and devastated and unexpected care environments, that's, I think, the best thing that could come out of energy, you know, in the sword. And I think it's happening. So I think every year, I think we're better than we were the year before, which isn't necessarily, you know, can be said of all healthcare innovations in our country right now. But really, I think every move we make is moving forward. So I salute you guys for taking the time to pay attention to this, because that's what it needs, is attention and training and enhanced team support.
Well, that's what we come down to a lot, Joe. You know, we talk a lot. Paragon Medical Education Group with Joe and Jim are our sponsors for this show, and they've helped us put this show out for going on, you know, a year and a half now. And it's one of the things that we've been able to do primarily because we've had that support and we've been able to get this information out there. But Joe, you guys at Paragon talk all the time about these being like once in a lifetime events, these major disaster events striking communities. And it seems to mesh very well with what Seth's talking about of being prepared and taking your knowledge to the next level and being aware of the possibilities of what could occur.
Well, I'd agree with that, Jamie. You know, I think a lot of that has to do with just the fact that many healthcare providers only get to participate in one or maybe two major disasters in their career. And the training and stuff that Beth is talking about is something that could be advantageous and useful to you on a much more frequent basis, especially if you're in situations that are more austere. You know, you just happen to be the guy out on the highway when you come across something that's going on there. So it's a very complementary skill set, I think.
So where can folks find Paragon if they want to find out a little bit more about what you guys do and track down a resource for their community or their system that they can bring you guys in to do a major event or help them prepare for things like active shooters or man-made disasters, natural disaster events?
Well, Paragon is on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com. And on Facebook under the same name, Paragon Medical Group as well. And our Twitter handle is, Paragon Med EDU. And of course, you can always reach us at the Disaster Podcast.
And Seth, how about you? You know, is there a way that folks, if they are interested in more information about wilderness EMS and being able to increase their knowledge of how to take care of these situations and be better prepared for these situations, and maybe if they're interested, join a team in their community?
Yeah, there absolutely is, and I want to make sure that I'm clear that there's not really the heart and soul of wilderness medicine is the 99% of people who take it who are not expecting to be part of an EMS response team and take it for altruistic reasons or because as part of their work as a guide or recreational activities as a climber or a rafter, whatever they want to know. So certainly there's a huge, rich training environment for people simply to become, just like we're saying, better prepared to deal on a highway or a river with something that comes up. So I mentioned the school that I'm the medical director for, but there's schools throughout the country that offer great wilderness medicine training. And in the Southeast, I started a nonprofit called the Appalachian Center for Wilderness Medicine that maintains a calendar that can be found on Google. If you look for AppWildMed or Appalachian Center for Wilderness Medicine, and we try to just put all the wilderness medicine events we know of in the Southeast or Southern Appalachians on there, because accessing this information is sometimes hard, and there's a lot of private schools that don't have a collective calendar. But in your community, if you just Google wilderness medicine or wilderness EMS, or look to people that you know are responders, they'll often know multiple schools that provide that kind of training. And then, like I said, there's a wilderness EMS medical director course that happens nationally, usually through the Wilderness Medical Society or the National Association of EMS Physicians, as a pre-conference to one or both of their conferences. And then, boy, there's just a huge number of local and national training programs in various elements of survival and wilderness medicine and wilderness EMS certification training. So I think that you can't, if you look in the right places, you can't help but find some really, just like we were saying earlier, looking through the Landmark Learning programming, you can't help but find something that sounds really exciting.
Well, hey, Jamie. Thank you. Go ahead, Jim.
Yes, Jim. So since we're on the advertisement issue of this, and we're talking about community, so we're talking about us in the community, but I think the most important thing is what was mentioned several minutes ago was community resilience. So for every listener out there, if you can reach out to your local emergency management agency and see about helping out with a CERT class, a community emergency response training, that would help out in times of disasters more than anything in the world.
Absolutely. And we've talked about that before, but we didn't talk about it in this episode. And I think that's a great point. It's kind of the community version of a wilderness first aid course, teaching you how to be prepared for that disaster situation. So great point. And that's CERT, CERT training. You can reach out to your local emergency managers, talk to your local fire department or EMS service, and they can put you in touch with how to do that. Seth, thanks so much for all those resources that you sent to me. I'll make sure I have links to these things in the show notes for this episode, because I think people are going to be very interested in finding more about this and seeking out some training and maybe some opportunities to do some service in and around their areas. So thanks a lot for coming on. I hope you'll come back.
Oh, absolutely. I would love to. It's been a lot of fun. And I think, what I told you about my story was true. I became a physician and built an entire career from a wilderness EMT course I took with Solo in New Hampshire in the early 1990s. So this is one of those things that can be, you go in thinking you're just going to learn something to help other people, and it ends up transforming your life. So I think if even a couple people get reached by it, both wilderness and disaster patients will be well served.
So Sam, where can folks find you?
Oh, I just got to say, so the risk is if you get interested in disaster medicine, you may end up a doctor. I love that. And I have to say to Seth, too. I have to say to Seth, too, I just think we scratched the surface on a lot of stuff we can talk with you about, so I really do hope we can get you back on again. You can find me in the usual social media places, Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, whatever else, and most certainly on the Disaster Medicine DisasterPodcast.com. And I do hope that folks come on. I'm sure there'll be, I can't believe there wouldn't be a good response to this episode. And we'd love, if you have questions for Seth, I would guess that he'd be willing to answer them. So please jump up there and ask them questions, and also let us know what else you're interested in. And Jamie, where do we find you?
Well, you can find me under the handle PodMedic on most locations out there on social media and the web. And of course, over at disasterpodcast.com. And like Sam said, leave a comment. You know, there's a comments link below every episode. And some episodes get some good comments. Some of them don't get any. But we're hoping that if you have a question for Seth or curious about anything, or if I missed any of the links that he talked about when I put the show notes together, when we go ahead and edit and put this episode together, I hope you'll reach out to us and let us know in the comments area, and we can get back to you. I check that frequently, and then the rest of the team also comes on and checks it. And if there's a question for Seth, I'll email him the link as well, and he can come in and leave an answer. But either way, we want to hear back from you. This is a community effort. We want to know, do you want more of these types of discussions to compare other types of austere medicine or not? So continue to reach out to us and let us know what you like. And we've got some more great topics coming up for you later on in the summertime. We've been putting quite a few resources together. So stay tuned here. It's going to be a lot of good stuff coming. But Sam, you know, this has been a great discussion.
Oh my God. Yeah. And like I said, I think Seth has just a well of information we haven't even begun to get to the bottom of yet. So we're going to have him back again. But I think this is just another example. It's a very different subject than we've talked about most of the time, but it's just another example of disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.